Hello and welcome to Credit Notes, a new podcast in partnership with AIG that aims to provide a deeper dive into the world of trade finance and the critical issues impacting global commerce. My name is Sam Lowe. I'm a partner at Flint Global and head of its trade and market access practice. Joining us today for our second episode to discuss whether countries can become too dependent on each other for the supply of essential products are Sir Julian King, former EU Commissioner for the Security Union, and Alicia Garcia Herrero, Chief Economist for Asia Pacific at Natixis and Senior Fellow at the European think tank Bruegel. Welcome both. Thanks for being here.
Same here.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let's just get into the discussion, and I thought we could begin by, I suppose, if not agreeing, discussing a definition. As in, so how would you define overdependence in the context of global commerce, global trade? Julian, I might start with you on this.
So, I think there are a number of factors to bear in mind. I'm not pretending this is completely scientific, and there is obviously an element of political assessment and judgment involved as well. But it is about considering how dependent you are on a single or a limited number of suppliers. So it's understanding your supply chain dependencies. I think it's also about the nature of that supplier or suppliers, their reliability, any restrictions that might affect them. And also here, there's an element of political judgment that comes in, I think, whether there are risks of policy alignments getting in the way of continued supplies or political differences interrupting supplies. And then a third factor, which I think is worth bearing in mind, is how critical is a particular input to your economic dependence as well. So a number of factors. Now you can assess some of those more or less objectively. Others, as I say, involve an element of political judgment.
Alicia, would you agree with that? Is there anything that you would add? And I also wondered, you know, can you quantify this in some way? Is there a threshold above which you are overdependent on another country? Let's say a certain critical product accounts for over 60% of your imports. Are you overdependent, or is it not that simple?
Well, it isn't simple, and I quite agree with the definition, by the way. It isn't simple, but I think there is a number of things we could do using input-output data. Perhaps we don't have enough granularity in existing data sets at global level, but I think it would be good to work perhaps on a sector and see not only the degree of dependence in terms of our imports and whether this is an intermediate good or a final good, which does make a difference, but also whether there is a substitute in case we wanted to diversify. In other words, it's not only whether, say, we have concentrated our imports because it's cheaper, but there's so many other suppliers if we wanted to. So I guess we need to look at first whether our imports are concentrated, second, whether there are other options. And that's that second part, I think, is very, very important. We know that in many cases there aren't second options, or they are very, very expensive. And I think that second part needs to be done beyond the actual dependence.
Yeah, I remember sort of, it's not the first time I came across this, but the one that always sticks out in my memory is during COVID, when the UK suddenly realized it was 2 weeks away from running out of paracetamol. And this is sort of, it feels, because it's such a generic medicine that you'd think that it'd be very easy to substitute out. But actually all of the suppliers essentially ran through India. And India was talking about restrictions. And this sort of leads on to my next question, and maybe coming back to you, Alicia, is this a new thing, or is it something that has been around for a while? Is there a particular reason why we're talking about this under lots of different headings now?
Well, I would say this, in a way, it is a new thing. And I think the reason is that the world was not globalized before it became globalized. And, you know, for many years, we were very inefficient. So we were producing paracetamol everywhere. And we just didn't realize how much cheaper it would be to produce it only in a certain place because of economies of scale. globalization brought us here. I think it has a lot of advantages, but we need to realize that to have more resilient supply chains, we don't necessarily need to go back and produce everything on our own. But I think we need to map those supply chains and know where else we could draw from in case India were to say, sorry, I'm imposing controls or you name it. So, you know, let me share with you very briefly the example of Taiwan, which is where I am now in Taipei, and what they did in the midst of COVID. They, as everybody else, they didn't have, say, masks. And, you know, they were very hesitant, as you can imagine, to board from China, from the mainland. So they suddenly started producing everywhere in places where you wouldn't imagine those masks could be produced. And I guess many other countries did that, you know. But the point is, so that's quite an easy thing to produce. Can you do that with something else? And if you don't, are you ready to find the place to do it? Is the technology readily available? Are the components, the inputs readily available? We could go all the way to critical raw materials in the case of renewables. I mean, we would need to map the availability, not necessarily produce everything on our own soil, but be able to map that availability and be able to react. I think that's the bare minimum we should be doing. And that's what, for me, resilience of supply chains is really about.
And Julian, I imagine this sort of resonates with you, because I know we were both discussing this the other day, but this idea of overdependency in a European context and how to manage it sort of developed under your watch in the context of 5G. And I was sort of wondering if, you know, obviously please respond to Alethea, but I'd be quite interested in your sort of ruminations on that period.
Well, I will do that. But on your original question, is this new? Well, clearly, as we've just heard, supply chain integration is not new. But the perspective that people have on some of these issues, I think, has developed over recent years, developed and changed. And broadly, that's because of a heightened sense politically, but then also across the business, the wider business community, and indeed civil society, of security risks. So obviously there's some very real hard defense risks that have gone right up the agenda, not least with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But there's a wider sense, I think, of having to take more account of security considerations, broad security considerations. So energy security, obviously, but a wider notion of economic security that has definitely risen up the agenda, and which means that the way people approach some of these issues is different today to how they did it a few years ago. So that is the change that I would want to draw attention to. Now, you mentioned one particular example from a European perspective. When I was in the Commission, we started to shift our framework for thinking about China. That was because of concerns across Europe about various aspects of Chinese behavior. It was also, to be frank, because of the political backdrop, where the US and China had entered a new phase in their power competition. And the US administration, then the first Trump administration, were pressing the Europeans, their allies, to take that into account when they were thinking about their degree of economic dependency on China. And what particular area where Trump, members of the administration, Secretary Pompeo and others were particularly focused was a European, Western dependency on Chinese-supplied technology in communications, and particularly around 5G, with a couple of Chinese suppliers being very, very dominant in the European market, and Huawei being the most well-known, I think. And they wanted to encourage the Europeans and other Western allies to reduce their dependency on those Chinese suppliers. It was easier said than done. They had very little Chinese tech in their 5G network. The Europeans had much, much more, building on years of Chinese sales of technology across Europe. And so unplugging that was going to cost an enormous amount of money and be extremely disruptive at a time when it wasn't clear what you would replace it with. So the pressure to do something was definitely there. The need to do it in a way that respected the realities on the ground in Europe had to be taken into account realistically. And so we developed a new way of looking at the issues. And we developed something called 5G Toolbox, which was essentially doing in practice what Alethea has just described as the challenge here. It was an analysis of the supply chain dependencies and the risks associated with those, and over time, setting out a proposal for trying to deal with those risks and mitigate them to diversify supply, develop alternatives and substitutes, and to improve resilience. And it's taken some time to roll that out. Indeed, it's only now being rolled out in some of the major European countries concerned. Thinking of Germany, yeah, who've taken quite a long time to do this, but it set the track both for this sector and more generally for what has in shorthand become known as a sort of economic security approach to dealing with some of these large-scale economic dependencies.
And I suppose in this context, we've been viewing dependencies as negative. But Alethea, you're in Taiwan, and I think Taiwan sort of has an interesting case study in which they arguably have weaponized the rest of the world's dependency on the country for the supply and production of high-end chips in order, this is a narrative, please disagree with me, in order to guarantee its security and to ensure that the US would step in to protect it. And, you know, have I misrepresented that? Was that a deliberate strategy? Is it working? I'm just interested if you have a view.
Sure. So here we are literally on the opposite end of a supply chain resilience. Here we were talking about dominance to stay resilient.
Yeah.
We could summarize into this expression, well-known expression for Taiwan, the Silicon Shield. So it was this purposely designed. My sense is not really. I think Taiwan was really desperate after being kicked out of the UN and not really knowing exactly what to do with its economy. And I think, you know, the chip kind of the moving into chips was, you know, basically never to imagine that they would become the center of the world for high-end semiconductors, to be very frank. In fact, in many instances, everybody thought Samsung would be indeed the center. As we speak, you basically have Samsung moving out of AI chips and having Korean IXC in the center in Korea, but much smaller than TSMC. How that happened, I think, is market-driven, to be very frank. I don't think that was... But there you go. You obviously have this position of strength. I think this really creates, beyond the usual suspects, mostly from the mainland, sometimes India for pharmaceutical, another type of concern for Europe, because no matter whether Taiwan is a democracy, it's not about that. We are heavily dependent on AI chips from Taiwan. So is the US, for that matter. And I think, you know, we need to realize that in the case of Taiwan, I would say the additional risk we run is that this is, and we suffered quite dramatically in September 2021. There was a drought here, and basically they just couldn't produce. There was not enough water to produce semiconductors, and then you could have earthquakes, you name it. So, you know, it's very... I would say that Taiwan is a very good case to really show that even for Taiwan, in a way, it's not a position you want to be in, because you become central in case things go wrong when you wouldn't want to be that central. So the Silicon Shield becomes a problem if it happens for the wrong reason, i.e. a drought rather than an invasion. So, you know, I just think that Taiwan has taken the right decision, in my mind, which is to diversify, to become to create multinationals. TSMC today is a multinational in Japan, in the US, in Germany. Why? Indeed, to reduce that risk. So you can run a risk even if you, in a way, you are on the other side of the equation. Taiwan is on the other side of the equation, but it's running a risk against the rest of the world because of that excessive concentration of production. I'm not sure China sees things that way, because China is larger and it sees its ability to leverage. But Taiwan does see it this way, I can only tell you. They're very worried about an earthquake stopping the production of high-end chips, for example. And they think of other plans as a way to mitigate that risk. That doesn't mean they won't control the IP or, you know, they will, but that's fine. The question is, can you still produce? I think that's what we worry about. So that's what I wanted to say about Taiwan.
Julian.
So I think that's interesting because right at the top, you were saying, how do you assess dependency? And we've given a couple of examples where single source suppliers are part of the risk assessment. But it's worth underlining again that the reliability of supply is a key part of the assessment as well. So here's a fascinating example where a dominant supplier, a single source supplier, is taking steps to diversify the sources of their supply in order to underline that they can remain a reliable supplier, which will encourage people to continue to work with them and not to have to have a policy of deliberately moving to other suppliers. So it works both way around.
It's fascinating because my next question was going to be around taking into account some of the examples we've discussed, and there's not one major one we haven't, which I'd like to return to. Has weaponization been effective? And the Taiwan example here is interesting now, because from what you're saying, Lithia, it's been effective in one sense, but actually it's become a bit of a burden as well.
So maybe I should clarify. I don't think Taiwan has weaponized.
Right, yes.
So Taiwan, I fully agree. Taiwan is in this, you know, single supplier kind of situation, which could be weaponized. But I think Taiwan is, and frankly speaking, probably because its position is weak enough not to even dare weaponize. It would be extremely counterproductive. Taiwan, as far as the mainland is concerned, I wouldn't call it weaponization. It's just following U.S. Export controls, basically. It's not in the trilateral agreement with the Netherlands and Japan, but frankly speaking, I mean, you don't even need to put Taiwan there because it's just going to follow no matter what in terms of single end user, blah, blah, blah. So I don't think, in a way, Taiwan is weaponized. And what Taiwan is doing, I fully agree, is like, on the contrary, reducing the risk of its single point of entry as a supplier. Why isn't China doing that? Why isn't China, you know, creating, I don't know, like other sources of 5G elsewhere, or, you know, I don't know, you could think of many other areas. Well, in a way, they are for renewables, they're producing elsewhere, you know, batteries and so on, but I don't think they would not go all the way with highest end technology. To be very frank, there's still a question mark on TSMC doing that, as you know. I mean, the U.S. is expecting TSMC to produce the highest-end chips in the U.S. TSMC is reluctant for a number of reasons. So, you know, I'm not saying it's perfect, but I think TSMC is not in the same, and this is a question of what kind of government you have behind. Yeah, I mean, TSMC can't play this game that Huawei can play, in my opinion. So, now, as Europeans, we need to take this into account. Whenever the game can play this is not in our favor, we need to be even more adamant to diversify our supply chain, because we won't have any other way to deal with this. So, and I just want to add on diversification, which is a different thing, but I don't want to forget, is that we can't expect to find the sourcing without doing anything about it. This is about the US, Europe, major investors in the world. I want to remind everybody on what Japan did when, you know, pressed through retaliation by China on critical raw materials. They just went all the way to Australia. They reduced their dependence. They invested in Australia. That's what I want to say. They invested. They didn't only try to buy somewhere here and there in Africa, in as we're doing, you know, with strategic agreements. No, no, no. They used investment. I think we need to go further. Investing to diversify, not just hoping to diversify. And I think we're very far from that. We are just very, I would say, not active enough in our investment to achieve that diversification, especially in critical raw materials and beyond. Yeah.
And is it possible without a really immediate trigger? So if I think about arguably a recent success story in diversification, if we think about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and European member states, particularly Germany, but others, reliance on Russia for energy, that reliance is still there to a degree. But there was I think it was described as the dash for gas, where all of a sudden it was discussions with the US, with the Gulf, seeking alternatives. And arguably, thanks to some fairly warm winters, the EU has managed to ride that out to a degree. But that was a pretty serious trigger. So Japan's a good example of maybe of where this has happened without such an extreme trigger. But is that possible sort of in the other areas we're talking about, green tech, chips? Julian, you wanted to come in.
Well, no, I was just thinking, you were talking about weaponization, and we've gone into some of the complexities of the Taiwan case. But there's a sort of clearer example, which we might also discuss a little bit. I think most commentators would say that China, Chinese authorities, are more or less consciously weaponizing certain critical minerals and their processing. So they control the production of about 30 critical minerals and metals. And what's interesting is beyond those that they control, they've invested enormously in processing other critical minerals and inputs, especially on the electric vehicles, batteries side. So even when they don't control the bulk of the production, they go to the market, they buy, they build refining infrastructure, and indeed develop refining technology and re-export. And they consciously put themselves in a sort of dynamic controlling position in supply chains. And then, if further evidence was needed of, you know, a conscious attempt to try and do this, they go around banning the export of some of the technology that they have developed that is needed to do the processing. So I think, if you look around, you can find quite clear cases of where a country's authorities are setting about in a systematic way, trying to pull towards them all of the influence connected with key supply chains.
But this is interesting in that it goes to Alicia's point, that if you were to try and combat that and set up alternative supply chains, alternative sources of processed materials, it would have to be quite deliberate, as a country or a collection of countries. You would have to choose to invest in that processing capacity. You'd probably have to accept some of the downside of hosting that processing, given the sort of negative environmental spillovers. And I suppose my observation is that, you know, from my perspective, it tends to be talking to UK government or European governments. Governments like talking about this stuff, but doing it, that seems to be the gap, because it's either expensive, politically difficult, or hard, just in general.
To add just a tiny bit on exactly Julian's point on what we could actively do on critical raw materials. So we wrote a paper I just shared on the risking while decarbonizing, exactly on what to do, given China's absolute dominance, really, on the full supply chain of critical raw materials, not only critical raw materials, but the whole green tech. And to make the point loud and clear that we can't do this just passively, we propose what we call a partnership, meaning not only we Europeans, let alone even the G7, but, you know, bringing along countries that can either produce, refine, or for that matter, I mean, have the extraction capacity, the refining, but also the... So what I'm trying to say here is that we can't expect to solve our supply or improve our supply chain resilience on our own. It's just not possible. And I think we sometimes forget in a very passive way, just, you know, controlling the risk, mapping the supply chains, all of that is fine, but it's not enough by all means and purposes. So that's what I wanted to add.
So one of the things I sometimes think about as well is that resilience building in this context sometimes comes into conflict with other sort of policy objectives. So if we think about sort of the increased burden placed on companies by supply chain due diligence rules, these are arguably in isolation a positive step in that it holds companies to account for labor practices, environmental practices through their supply chain. But if you are urgently trying to diversify your supply chains, for example, your sourcing of critical minerals and the like, those two policy objectives could quite quickly come to a head insofar as it might not be possible to have fully audited supply chains that are fully compliant with all the different legislation you want and access raw materials quickly. I think that conflict is something that you just don't really see discussed very much. These sort of conversations tend to happen in isolation because it's hard, because you sort of have to accept compromise. But in terms of, I suppose, looking forward, Julian, yeah, you come in.
I think that's obviously right. But I think those conflicts might emerge more into the light of day, and I think they might become more discussed. Indeed, they might become more controversial if some of the policy developments that we've seen recently continue and strengthen. In particular, if we have at the other end of the spectrum from what we've been talking about, the one end of the spectrum, you've got thinking about your dependency, building your resilience. The other end of the spectrum, you've got moves to boost your independence. You know, one policy response to all of this is, well, we'll do it ourselves and we'll do whatever's necessary to do it ourselves. Now, obviously, there are some physical constraints to that, but you move along in that direction. And the policy debate in the United States at the moment appears to many observers to be moving along in that direction under the current administration. And certainly if there were a change of administration, voices like the recently nominated vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance have for some time been saying what we really need to do is take much more seriously the need to be really independent in some of these critical areas. And if that has an economic cost or conflicts with other policy objectives, like nice relations with other countries who are on the whole friendly, well, so be it, because the objective should be, one, a security objective, and two, for the wider economic development and sustainability of our country in particular, this is the objective we should follow. So the technical conflict of objectives that you were talking about, I think, has every chance of becoming very political.
And it is interesting, isn't it, how discussions about resilience very quickly become political discussions about self-sufficiency. Which, when the two are definitely not the same. My sort of example is if you have a fire in a warehouse and it's where you get all of your, I don't know, masks from, and that warehouse is in your country or another country, it's still a problem if you're only getting your masks from one place. But politically, that conversation gets warped very, very quickly. But Alicia, looking at the world as it is now, what do you see as the sort of key risks? What's on your radar?
I think green tech is extremely important, first of all, because we say it's important. So, you know, just imagine, yeah? I mean, basically, we are stuck with gas, Russia, I mean, at least Central Europe. Suddenly, I mean, we make gas our transition energy with nuclear, which, frankly, we all know that, you know, many don't go along with. So it's gas, yeah, for many, just gas. So you make gas extremely important for the transition, and suddenly you have this huge problem. So you need to speed up renewables. And then what do you have at the other end of the street? A single country providing renewables, by the way, in a way that you would not have imagined, because you were a while ago the largest producer of renewables, you, Europe. I mean, it's like a horror movie. So, I mean, you need to diversify, because otherwise you're going to end up on the same path you were before with gas. So for me, green tech is extremely important, and I wouldn't stop at solar panels. We're very late for that, or even batteries. But, you know, think about wind turbines. We're losing that again. What about green hydrogen? If you talk to experts, they tell you we're losing that one again. So it's not only the present and the past, it's actually the future. So for me, clearly, if we want to keep our goals in terms of reduction of emissions, you name it, net zero, green tech is extremely urgent. But then there's many others in the event of a pandemic, whether it's, you know, pharmaceuticals or to be very frank, even security related issues. Yeah, I mean, whether it's 5G, 6G, when we get there, but for security related issues. Yeah, so I think we need to think of pockets of different types of risk, security being one. And then, you know, if you focus on something, say, green transition, then you need to be less dependent. And then kind of pandemic related or, you know, like health related shock. So, and there may be others I'm missing, but I think you need to map the different reasons why you need to do something urgently, and then prioritize. You need to prioritize these objectives. And if you can't do them all together, then you might revise certain targets. I'm not saying we have to say that. It won't be me, but I'm saying if you can't do everything at the same time, you need to take some action. And I don't think we're there. We're just kind of rumbling, yeah, on this issue, rumbling without any decision.
I'm conscious of time and me taking yours up. So sort of hone in on the conclusion. Sort of looking forward, we sort of discussed sort of known risks and issues around energy supply, chips, medicines, critical raw materials. Is there anything on the horizon that you're starting to think about that could become sort of central to this discourse? Or do you think it's just more of the same? And maybe Alicia, I'll start with you.
Well, I think moving to what to do, I think we need to realize that, yes, there's a lot we can do on our own, but it won't be, as I mentioned, enough. We need to think of beyond Europe. I mean, where are the places we can invest, produce, and import, which are not correlated or not dependent on where our dependencies come from? I think that's basically the way to look at this. And therefore, we would need to also change our partnerships. I feel like the world is moving very differently. So I just saw India, Indonesia, and Australia, you know, working on mini laterals to, guess what? You know, Australia has the critical raw materials in Indonesia too. India has the ability to produce. Yeah, I mean, it's like such a... So, you know, I think we need to move away from the... Yes, very rigorous and very green and very perfect trade deals that we've always pushed, but the world has changed. I don't think we can do everything with trade. We can punish everything with trade. We need to use trade more for carrots than for sticks, which I think is where we are. And that would help us build more resilient supply chains, partially with our own abilities, maybe some kind of minimum critical stocks that we want to produce. But then, of course, for the bulk of it, if you want to diversify, say, I don't know, solar panels, 90% imported from China, you cannot produce 90% of your solar panels in Europe. So you need somewhere else, which where you have an alliance, where you really can say, okay, this is not going to be weaponized. You would still import maybe 50% from the mainland, but, you know, it's going to be 50%, not 90%. So I guess we need to work on those, on realities. So we can't just decouple and import nothing from the from China, but we also have to reduce that dependence. And for that, I think we need partially our own ability, minimally, because it's very expensive, but also rely on other partners and be much more open to those partners than we are today. That for me is clearly not working. If we look at the speed in which we sign trade agreements, only if it's New Zealand, we're fast, you know. But New Zealand is not going to solve our problem. So I'm sorry to be so blunt, but it's just not going to work in at the speed needed.
Julian.
Well, I agree with that. In terms of sectors, you were asking about sectors that might come into focus. Well, the Commission itself has set out a list of areas that it's asking the member states to examine, and that includes chips, AI, quantum, biotech, energy tech, space tech, connectivity. So there's quite a lot of sort of questions about how sustainable and reliable will our access continue to be across these cutting-edge technologies. So there's lots of work to do. I couldn't agree more that the key is speed. We need to speed up. We gave an example earlier on in this discussion of the discussion around 5G. It was a good discussion. It broke new ground, but it took years to get some countries to move, to take the necessary steps. And some are still a long way from taking all of the necessary steps to follow through the conclusions that were jointly reached. So there's a real question of speeding up both the analysis and following the analysis, the necessary action. Maybe because of other wider geopolitical developments, both in friendly and in less friendly countries, the political will has increased to take the steps necessary. But I think there is a real question about how quickly we're going to be able to adjust our partnerships, as has just been discussed, and our policies to actually take effective action.
And just a final question. Lots of what we've been talking about has been the sort of policy discussion, sometimes bleeding over into investment decisions by governments or restrictions. How seriously is the private sector taking this? Or maybe if I reframe the question, has the discussions around overdependency, economic security led to a change in private sector behavior? I suppose at the acute end, you could argue yes, in terms of if a government imposes export controls, it has a direct impact on what companies are allowed to do and who they're allowed to sell to. 5G is probably another good example of where it's been slow, but it's clearly had an impact on private sector. But what about, you know, medicines, green tech? I mean, my view is I'm not so sure, but maybe you think otherwise.
So on private behavior, I think what I hear loud and clear is that they need more certainty as to what we mean by de-risking, say in the case of China, what we mean by supply chain resilience. I mean, we're not giving the private sector enough guidance, to be frank, as to what they should be doing. We need a clear path for the private sector for them to engage in de-risking and in improving resilience in their supply chain. I just don't think we're giving them enough clarity as to where they should be heading and how they should be doing this.
Julian.
These kinds of considerations definitely have real world business and economic effects. You mentioned the 5G example. So the shift in the market helped some of the suppliers. So Nokia and Ericsson definitely benefited from a move away from Chinese suppliers. But also, very interestingly, it promoted new technology development. So the whole area of Open RAN, which is a slightly different way of supplying 5G technology, was boosted because of this work on the economic security risks and brought in a whole range of new players and partners. So for anybody looking, again, it didn't happen quickly enough, but the risks and the shifts that are happening on the back of this kind of economic security debate are both increasing and speeding up. And so I think if the message hasn't already gone out, clear messages for business actors and commercial actors and investors, this is an area that is only going to get more disputed, more complicated, and where the shifts are going to speed up.
Thank you, Julian. And thank you, Alicia, for taking the time to talk with us today. Lots for me to think about. I'm going to draw it to a close here. I'd like to thank you both for joining us on the second episode of AIG's Credit Notes podcast.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Julian. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. So please join us again next time, where we're going to be discussing how climate change will impact global trade in terms of supply chain disruption. And also in future episodes, we're going to be doing a bit of a deeper dive on sanctions policy. Thank you all again. From me, Sam Lowe, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.